Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, the Republican mayoral candidate, Joe Loda. He's launching Democrats for Loda, says the Daily News. So you New York Democrats in the audience, you can see if he connects with you. Coming up in a little while, we will also ask, should Bill Thompson concede the Democratic primary right now? Does he risk helping Loda win by holding on against de Blasio? We will look at three innovative ways to make college a better deal today. And to call in on stories we missed while obsessing on Syria and primary day, tell us what other news you've been following. But we begin today with the complicated new diplomacy over Syria. Secretary of State Kerry arrived in Geneva a few hours ago to meet with his Russian counterpart, even as Vladimir Putin popped an op-ed piece into the New York Times today. Did you see it? Arguing the rebels probably use those chemical weapons. Stephen Cohen is professor emeritus of Russian studies at Princeton and NYU and co-author of an article in The Nation magazine called Syria, the Alternative to War. And Paul Danahar is Mideast bureau chief for the BBC and author of a new book called The Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Stephen Cohen, welcome back. Paul Danahar, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Steve Cohen, your Nation article subtitle is Now We Know a Diplomatic Solution is Possible. But do we really know that? Aren't we still figuring out if Russia and Syria are just stalling for time?
I'm not a web person. I didn't put that subtitle on it, so I don't know what the web editor had in mind. I think we do know what the Russians are proposing, because they've been proposing it all along. Discussions about putting Syria's chemical weapons under some kind of international control. The Russians favor United Nations, but the Russians have to play a central role here. It has been brooded in Moscow and international capitals for quite a while. In fact, my wife, Katrina Vandenhoeven, and I wrote that article 2 days before Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov proposed it, and then we kind of tweaked it to take into account that proposal. But it's been in the air, it's been available, but the White House hasn't been interested until now.
The New York Times reports that the Russians have sent the U.S. a written proposal on how to handle Mr. Assad's chemical weapons, but administration officials say it lacks detail on how the stockpiles would be secured or verified or destroyed. If the Times is right, isn't that just the kind of vague step that would be intended to delay rather than get to yes?
I don't think so. I think what you're witnessing here is a struggle in the United States between the lobbies that want no cooperation with Russia on most anything. This is a long-standing position. And the much weaker and smaller lobby that's been arguing for many years that Russia is our most important potential partner. For example, it's absolutely preposterous to respond to the Russian proposal to put these weapons under international control by asking the Russians to work out all the details. Many countries have a lot of experience with controlling and destroying chemical weapons. The two leading countries who have destroyed the most are, in fact, Russia and the United States. But there is a special United Nations unit based in Europe that oversees this. What we're hearing in the American media are people saying it's too hard, it's not possible. But stop and think, what's the alternative? You can't destroy them by air. You can't release those chemicals into the air. So the alternative is either take control of them, destroy them the way chemical weapons have been destroyed in Russia, the United States, Iraq, I think Albania, about five or six other countries. It will take a long time. It will be complicated. It will be expensive. But the technology exists, and the question now is there a political way?
Now, Paul Danahar, BBC North America bureau chief, former Mideast bureau chief, the subtitle of your new book is The World After the Arab Spring. Putin doesn't use the term Arab Spring in his op-ed in the Times today, but he makes the case that the Syrian rebels are not fighting for democracy, which is what we like to think the Arab Spring is all about. They're fighting for their al-Qaeda-linked sectarian advantage. How do you see Syria in the context of the Arab Spring democracy movement?
Well, I think at the beginning it was a democracy movement. The problem was that it was allowed to basically fester into an internecine civil war. At the beginning, the people that I met at the start of the civil war and the protesters that I met in Damascus, they wanted the same as everybody else. But over time, the people that were trying to keep things political and peaceful were being locked up or they were being shot. There was no help coming from anywhere else. And over time, many of these young people became radicalized because the only people that were putting money and arms into the Syrian conflict to support the opposition were the Qataris and the Saudis. And that meant that if you wanted their money, you had to buy in, at least on the face of it, with their ideology. So I think the long, drawn-out process of deciding what to do about Syria helped radicalize it. I do think a great chunk of the people that are fighting now have been radicalized. I think there isn't really an FSA. It's just lots of different groups of men with guns. Some of them are just bandits. Some of them are still fighting for the ideals of the original uprising, and some of them are fighting to create some form of Islamic State. So Syria is a complete mess. I don't think it needed to be this much of a mess if there had been something a bit more proactive at the beginning, but it's very, very difficult to see how we get out of it now.
Paul, the Putin op-ed refers to al-Qaeda fighters among the Syrian rebels. He writes that the United States has even designated al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant fighting with the opposition as terrorist organizations. How much do you know about the extent of their involvement?
Well, it's estimated that they're kind of 10 to 15% of the rebel groups that are fighting. But the reality is that they weren't at the beginning. But you've got a lot of young men that have found that the only way to get armed and to fight back is to join these groups. They are the best fighters. They came equipped with the knowledge that many of them had learned in Afghanistan and in Libya and in Iraq. And they have therefore attracted people to them because they have arms and they have knowledge. The locals simply didn't. And after kind of standing around in Homs and being mortared live on air and nothing happening, it was pretty much inevitable that it was going to go this way because, you know, Syria is a very, very complicated society, much more complicated than Libya or pretty much anywhere else in the region. So it isn't surprising that it's gone that way. I don't think it necessarily had to go that way. But as I say, it's difficult to know where we go now. I think that the key issue in terms of how to deal with the Syrian chemical weapons is, from my experience of being in Syria, the UN has trouble delivering food to people who are hungry. I mean, I spoke to someone in the UN and they told me a little while back that to try and get aid into Homs, they had to speak to 15 different rebel commanders. Mm. To try and get aid into areas held by the government, they had to go through myriad different bits of the government. So I think getting an international force on the ground and securing chemical weapons, I mean, to the point where you know you've got everything, will be very, very difficult.
Paul Danahar, author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. He's BBC correspondent who spent so much time in the Mideast. Also with us, Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Russian studies at Princeton and NYU and co-author of an article in The Nation magazine called Syria, the Alternative to War. And if you want to get in on this conversation, folks, you can with a comment or a question at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show to post a comment or on the phone, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Steve Cohen, here's one important way, it seems, that Obama and Putin may be on a collision course. Obama says if the chemical weapons aren't really given up, then the U.S. will return to a military option. Putin says the threat of force needs to be off the table in order to reach a final deal. Do you see this as a deal breaker in the making?
It all depends on the American side. The Russians will not vote for a resolution at the UN that contains a clause that if this doesn't work out, force is sanctioned. They will never vote for use of force against Syria, period. Can I rewind the story just a bit?
Sure.
Because I think it brings us back to your point. We Americans have a little trouble with history, even if it happened two or three days ago. If you look at Putin's op-ed article in today's New York Times, and this is not about the New York Times, but that the leader of Russia decided it was necessary, or his advisors decided it was necessary, to let his voice be heard directly in the United States. And the New York Times agreed. What this tells us is the following. Putin has been so demonized in the United States for so many years that very few people have paid any attention to what he's had to say about international developments. If we look at what he said about the Middle East since the beginning of the so-called Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt, he has propounded a narrative radically unlike the American narrative. The American narrative has been the Arab Spring is about democracy. Putin and the Russian analytical establishment, and Russia has more Middle East experts than we do, they've been tied to the Middle East for many, many years, has said no. What you call the Arab Spring is the destabilization of a critical area of the world that is bringing jihadists ever closer to power. The result will be chaos and extremism, and it will blow back into all of our countries, particularly Russia, which has 20 million Muslim citizens of its own. Everything that Putin's been saying for the last 2 years is in his op-ed piece. There's not a single thing new there. Look at one theme in particular. He's trying to save, he says, the United Nations and the Security Council as the alternative to war. But the United States, since the end of the Soviet Union, has turned to the Security Council only when it suits the purposes of the White House. That has aggravated and angered the Russians to no end, and now the moment has come, says Putin, to make a choice on how we're going to deal with these crises. He wants it at the United Nations. He won't vote for a military sanction. But in response to Paul's point about how hard this will be to take control of these weapons and eventually destroy them, he is 1,000% right. But what we have is the possibility that Russia, which is the best-connected country in Syria other than Iran, will take the leading role. The Russians know how to do it. They're prepared. It's their proposal, and they will work with the United Nations. But they won't do that if the United States insists, as the United States, France, and England were yesterday, I don't know what they're thinking today, that there be a clause in the resolution permitting, in the end, if things don't go the way we want, the use of force, then that's a deal breaker. So Washington, Obama, now is at a crossroads. He has to decide.
So is there a way, Steve, that both sides can save face around this conflict? Like, if the U.S. does not explicitly state a threat of military action in a Security Council resolution, but behind the scenes we know he still reserves the right, Obama?
Well, it's not behind the scenes, is it, Mr. Lehrer? After all, he's gone to the Congress. He's threatened to use military force. He did not intend, until Lavrov made his statement, even to consult the United Nations. I'm not a big believer that everybody has to save face, though I understand it's important for domestic political reasons. And by the way, Putin's put his face on the line inside Russia, very much so. He said to his Russian political class, I don't like Obama as a political leader. He's weak, and we can't rely on him. But in this instance, Russian interests and American interests are so much the same that we can count on Obama to do the right thing. So Putin's face is online, too. But look, you made the point. Until a few days ago, the White House was not talking under any circumstances about going to the United Nations. So whether it's in the resolution or not at the Security Council, it's clearly on the table. I mean, we don't have to beat that drum. And if we do beat the drum, it's just an attempt to undermine Putin's proposal.
But let me press that one step further, because Obama would argue that Russia wasn't going to lift a finger to do anything about Syria's chemical weapons, even after this attack, until Obama started talking credibly about military force. Do you disagree with that?
It's not a question of me disagreeing with it. There's two things to be said here. We don't know. There are many stories in the paper, including some from the administration, which wants to take credit for Putin's suggestion, that they had been talking about this going back a year and a half or more, that Putin and Obama talked about it in St. Petersburg about, 8, 9 days ago, that Kerry and Lavrov had talked about it. But the Times story that tried to detail this made the point that the White House didn't believe in it as a real possibility. And so, yes, of course, Putin wants to avoid the use of force. But when this arose, when the deal was reframed, it was Putin who seized the initiative. And now he's asking the United States to meet him halfway. And there's lots of analogies, the way Reagan met Gorbachev halfway 25 years ago. This is what you do if you're a statesman. If you're a politician, you worry about what people are going to say about you in Washington and Moscow.
Let's take a phone call. Richard in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Richard.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Okay, my main question is, for the past 2.5 years, there have been stories that the Central Intelligence Agency has been giving aid to the Free Syrian Army. But this very morning, I heard General Idris on, I think, NPR say that they have not received a single weapon. So what is going on with the CIA?
Richard, thank you. And Paul Danahar from the BBC, let me turn to you on that. Is it clear to you how much, if any, aid the Free Syrian Army or any rebel faction has gotten from the United States?
Well, not very much. I mean, most of the aid, there's been kind of avenues, basically, well, three, I guess. It began with Syrian businessmen basically funding the opposition until their reserves ran dry. In parallel to that, there was money coming in from the Qataris, who were basically funding anyone who'd pick up a gun and shoot in the right direction. And they weren't fussy about backing Al-Qaeda-linked elements, and they were quite public at that right at the beginning, talking about, you know, not trying to exclude anyone from the process. And then there was the Saudis, who I've been told by members of the FSA on the ground were paying for weapons, that the British were helping them work out how to get into the country, that the British weren't providing the weapons. So there have been a steady stream of arms going in, not nowhere near the amount that the Russians have been providing Assad with under their the deals they've had for many years to sell them off. With regard to the CIA, well, 6 months ago, the CIA was given the go-ahead to do something. There have been some recent reports. Finally, some of those weapons have been coming through, but they're not very sophisticated. They were running a kind of training program in Jordan to try and build something like an FSA class, officer class. But as people I've spoken to said, it wasn't particularly useful or particularly good. And the FSA, frankly, I mean, General Idris is really not in charge of anyone. I mean, the people that are speaking on behalf of the FSA, they're really only speaking for people that are sitting in hotel rooms outside the conflict. They had no command control structure for most of the fighters on the ground. There is no army as such. It's just different groups of people that, by and large, are pointing their guns in the same direction.
Let's take another call. Here is Ennis in Wayne. Ennis, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank
you. Actually, a terrific show.
Thank you.
I'm a Syrian American, and, you know, I kind of, like, agree 100% with there's actually one point I wanted to say initially, but then there's these other two things. I agree with the gentleman from the BBC about, you know, that the delay in helping the Syrian rebels helped radicalize the movement. If you guys remember, initially, they were not fighting at all. But they didn't find anybody to give them any money or any weapons to defend themselves. And they're seeing their families getting raped, getting killed, getting bombed, getting massacred with knives in front of their eyes without anything to do. So they would turn to anybody that would give them any aid. So I agree with him on that point 100%. And that's unfortunately our fault that we watched this happen. The main thing that I wanted to say, since when we, the United States, the defenders of freedom around the world and humanity, taking lessons from Putin, who massacres his people right and left, and the only thing that he did is to help his dictator to stay in power and to vote down any UN initiative to hold him responsible for killing his people. And now when he sees that the United States is serious and there's an actual use of force, he backed down completely and announced that they're not going to contribute in any war in Syria. But then he did this, like, gimmick to turn the attention to the chemical weapons. The whole idea here is that there's people getting massacred. There's 100,000 person getting killed in Syria. It's not by what they were killed. Of course, using the chemical weapons is another monstrosity that added to the whatever's going on in Syria. But, you know, that's not the main issue. It's one of the most important issues, yes. But it's not the main issue. The main issue is the killing.
Ennis, thank you very much. And Stephen Cohn, do you want to respond to Ennis? I guess particularly his part about the U.S. taking lessons from Putin, who massacres his own people?
I know of no instance when Putin has massacred his own people, unless your caller is referring to the war in Chechnya, which was a Russian civil war. The Kremlin, it began under Yeltsin, not under Putin. And the Putin regime has considered it a war against terrorism. And after the Boston bombings in the United States, American opinion, including White House opinion, began to share Putin's opinion. So factually, your caller is wrong. As for Putin's stake in this and why he's doing it, I think I've already spoken to that. The only thing I would add is that an American military strike will almost certainly, I think most people, Paul will can comment on this, but will almost certainly multiply the killing and the deaths in Syria, whether it because it escalates the fighting on both sides or because of the American strike will kill people.
Paul, what do you think about the prospect of the kind of American strike that President Obama and Secretary Kerry have started referring to? Do you think that would more protect people or cause more deaths?
I think it would make a huge amount of difference because I think it would be a very limited strike. It would take place over a couple of days. I don't think they would want to do anything that would destabilize the government too much because they're very scared about what might come in and replace it because they don't believe that there is an opposition that they can deal with that could run the country. So I'm not convinced that actually a short series of airstrikes would make a huge amount of difference in terms of the scale of the war. There would, of course, be casualties. But I think for the reasons that they don't want to change things very much on the ground, this is about chemical weapons. It's not about changing the dynamic interior. I don't believe actually it would make an enormous lot of difference. I think there's been an awful lot of talk about the impact it would have. I think after it was over, people would say, oh, well, okay, and then the war would just carry on.
But isn't that the point? I mean, I don't agree with you because Obama has already yielded to public pressure in this country in order to get congressional support by saying it won't be a pinprick. This will be a real strike. And they're no longer talking about 1 or 2 days. They keep referring to Kosovo in 1999 when the Clinton administration bombed what was then Yugoslavia, which lasted, I think, around 80 days. They don't intend to do that, but they're certainly going to do more than a pinprick. But here's the point. If they do, the White House, what they claim they're going to do, it will leave Assad with his chemical weapons. It will leave them there. It's just punishment. Look, don't use them again, but here, keep them. What the Russians are proposing is a way to get rid of them. I think it's a no-brainer. I mean, what's the alternative?
I think there's another issue here which we haven't discussed, which does play into the dynamic here. I'm talking from Israel, from Jerusalem. The Israelis are very frustrated in the way that this whole thing has played out. They would like to see, obviously, the chemical weapons being removed from Assad, but for them the bigger issue is Iran and to what extent when an American president draws a red line, he actually means it. I think the lesson that they are taking from this is that they really can't trust Obama to enforce any of the red lines he may or may not draw, that this is a president who's publicly stated he wants to keep America out of wars, doesn't want to get them into wars, and they are very nervous about that. So I think over and above the broader issue of chemical weapons, there is another factor here, and that is, I think, the fact that this has been such a drawn-out, convoluted and confusing policy approach towards Syria from America, which I think perhaps Stephen and I can agree on. I do think it is changed some of the dynamic on the ground with regard to the Iranians, in particular how the Israelis and this Israeli government sees the kind of action they may have to take if they don't think that America is going to stand by red lines that it draws.
Let's take another caller. Here is Harold in Tenafly, who read the Putin op-ed piece in the Times today. Hi, Harold.
Hi.
Go ahead.
In the Putin editorial, Putin said that he believes the chemical weapons and the gas attack were produced by the rebels, not by the Assad government. So who is he going to authorize the UN to examine? The rebels? the chemical weapons they hold? They don't hold any.
Well, that's Harold, that's a good question. So thank you for that. And so, Steve Cohen, do you find it to be credible at all that the rebels would have gone to that extent to set Assad up? Because that's what Putin alleges in the piece. He doesn't offer evidence. He offers an argument that the rebels did this because it would bring outside military intervention in on their side.
That's correct, and he has been alleging that for quite a while. But in our article, my wife, Katrina Vandenhoeve, and I call for the following, that if and when the UN session meets, that it begin with evaluating the evidence that exists as to who used these chemical weapons. Here's what we have. The United States says that it has high confidence. He doesn't say it's the Congress people who have seen the intelligence all report unanimously that it doesn't say American intelligence is 100% confident. It just says at a very high level of confidence, they are sure. So the Americans have intelligence. The Russians claim they have intelligence. And now we have, because I believe it's completed, the UN on-site inspection mission, which has not released its findings. Let those three agendas or empirical facts of intelligence be presented to the UN Council, to the Security Council. If it's clear that it was Assad, then we still have the non-military solution that we proposed in our article and that Putin has proposed in the New York Times and Lavrov, his foreign minister, a few days ago. Could I take 30 seconds to make a larger point?
Sure.
Look, we got to step back a little bit from the details, from how can we do this, is it possible, and look at what's being presented to us. Here's a chance for a real pivot in international relations. Who knows about these chemical weapons in Syria? Well, there's the Syrian government, there are the Russians, there are the Iranians, and there are the Israelis, and there are the Americans. All of these countries have to contribute, if we're going to get rid of these chemical weapons, to what they know. Imagine if this can be done, the doors it opens for that kind of cooperation elsewhere. And there are a lot of dangerous crises coming down the road from Iran to Afghanistan to counterterrorism. But if we could get Iran, Israel, Syria, the United States, and Russia to cooperate on this one issue, imagine the precedent if statesmen are prepared to seize that opportunity.
Well, let's hope some kind of diplomatic progress is made for the sake of all concerned. And we thank Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies at Princeton and NYU and co-author with Katrina Vandenhoeve of an article in The Nation magazine called Syria, the Alternative to War, and Paul Danahar, Mideast Bureau Chief for the BBC, previously now their North America Bureau Chief, but author of a new book called The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Thank you both very much for having this conversation.
Many thanks to you.
Thanks very much.